Will counsel for the matter of marriage of Jindal, and I probably haven't pronounced that correctly, please come forward.
I know who I am.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel for the appellant, ready?
Ready, Your Honor. And that was a correct pronunciation.
Go ahead when you're ready.
We need to fix the clock.
She'll have it in a minute. Still says 30 seconds.
It does say 30 seconds.
There we go.
Thank you. First, a very brief statement of the fact.
What is your name again?
Start out by stating your name and your registration number, please.
My name is Neil McFarland, and I represent the respondent in the court below, Yolanda Jindal.
And just, I'll ask you the same question I asked in the preceding case. What is the standard of the review to which the court here must consider?
Abuse of discretion.
And thank you.
This is an appeal from the permanent orders in a dissolution of marriage action. The parties were married 11 and a half years total. There were four children. There are no issues regarding the children on the appeal. They did amass a substantial amount of property, and all the issues, the three issues, go to the division of the marital property. The first is we contend the trial court abused its discretion in awarding a disproportionate amount of the marital property to the petitioner.
To that extent, Mr. McFarland, is a 60-40 split generally the numbers?
Yes, 60-40. I say 61-39. They say 51,
yes,
59-40.
Okay,
60-40 split in the marital property. As I've indicated, the parties do seem to agree on a great deal of the law in this case. The standard review is abuse of discretion. And I think we start on with section 14-10-113 of the revised statutes for division of property. And it indicates the trial court has the duty to divide the marital property in the proportion it deems just. The case law goes and interprets that further by saying the split must be fair or equitable. And our contention in this case is that simply it was not a fair split.
What would you think is a fair split?
I'm sorry?
What do you think is a fair split? 50-50?
Well, I would think my client, the respondent, should have more because of the third.
How much more?
I would say it should be 60-40 in reverse.
Oh, thank you.
The statute I cited, 14-10-113, puts out four factors to be considered, and three of those are very applicable. The first is the contribution of each party to the marital property. The second is the value of the property awarded to each. The third are the economic circumstances of the parties at the time of the permanent order. The fourth, increase or decrease in separate property, does not have much application. Contribution is big. There is one very big asset of marital property, and that is that they owned a house, a family house, worth some $735,000. That had equity of $403,000. That was awarded to the petitioner. When the parties were married in 1997, the petitioner, the respondent, had owned some nearly 2 acres in Arvada, Colorado, in upscale property, upscale neighborhood, and lived in a cottage of some 700 square feet, small cottage. The family lived there the whole time until he filed for the dissolution of marriage. In 2001, they started building a very large house, 8,000 square feet.
Excuse me, Mr. McFarland, I'm always concerned about what standard we should use and how it should be applied. And this your answer to your question was you think it should be 60-40 in favor of your client. The trial judge found it was 60-40 in favor of the husband. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, in the Ray marriage of Balsh, which the Colorado Supreme Court decided in 2001, the Supreme Court said, in so many words, I think they're correct, that an appellate court may not disturb a trial court's decision regarding a division of property unless there's been a clear abuse of discretion. And in this case, is there a clear abuse of discretion?
I believe there is.
Thank you.
Okay.
Again, the contribution, the wife had put in the property. Well, in 2001, they started building this huge house. In August of 2006, and the house is still not finished, it's probably 70 or 75% finished now. In August of 2006, which was just 11 months before petitioner filed for the dissolution, she quit claimed the property to himself and her, to the two of them. And at the time they were married, the property they testified was worth about $200,000. She indicated, she said $200,000. He indicated $180,000, and there was $90,000 mortgage on it. So there was equity in the property of right at $100,000. The trial court recognized that amount in its ruling, but just recognized it. It did not show that it gave her any credit for that contribution. There is nothing to show that that contribution was considered by the court at all. And that is our first claim.
Well, if it's included, if he recognized it, then he or she must have considered it.
She recognized it. She said that I could almost read from her language.
They have concluded not to give it any weight. But
I'm sorry?
She may have concluded not to give it any weight.
Well, okay, then apparently she said no weight. In other words, she didn't give her any value for the contribution. Then. Yet that is a factor that's to be considered. There's no language from the trial court that she said, because of this, I'm going to award you more property, any such language as that. So that the contribution, there's $100,000 there, we feel the trial court did not consider in its ruling. The court did at the end say there's a disproportionate division of property, so I'm going to order the petitioner to pay the great majority of the family debts. Well, that might be true, but it still ended up with a 60-40 split in the division of property, and that's net after the debts are subtracted from the property awarded to each. So we think the contribution, the trial court did not consider the contribution of the respondent in this case. And the parties, they lived and worked together during their marriage and also had four children and raised those children, but they worked equally during the marriage. It was not a case where the husband was bringing in a huge amount of money and she was not. The second factor is the value of the property to be divided to each, and that's approximately a $500,000 to the husband and petitioner and $245,000 to the respondent. We have both set forth what we think the actual value is in our briefs, and we differ somewhat. But even when we differ, we come up with very, very close to 40-60 split. And there's no reason to justify such disproportionate division. In fact, if you look at the behavior of the petitioner, there's something that suggests it should go the other way, and that is that, of course, she contributed that property and then quit-claimed it to him, and just 11 months later, he went ahead and filed a petition for divorce or dissolution. The house was awarded to him because he had obtained custody of the children in a temporary order, and because he had custody of the children, the court awarded him the family property. The affidavit he used to obtain the children has pretty much been disproven as false by simply a lot of UA.
That's not an issue.
That's not an issue, but that's how he ended up with the property.
Isn't that a factor the judge can consider, where the children are going to live?
Oh, yes, we don't disagree. The law is clear on that. The court may do that and properly did that. The third factor I think is so important in this case, and that is the economic circumstances of the parties. At the time that the parties were married, they were running a bar, or operating a bar that had been operated a few years before that by the petitioner. Gross income, some $400,000 to $500,000 a year. They lost that because the city took it for urban renewal, and then they started another bar. But they were running his bar during the marriage. After, and they were going to open a new bar, and that was about a month before that, he filed a petition for dissolution. The respondent opened the bar, was able to run it for 9 months, and then she was evicted for failure to pay the rent. She just lost the bar. She couldn't run it. In their brief, they talk about her mismanagement, and that indicates that she does not have any ability or such ability as he does to operate it. He has since taken over the bar and has ran it for the last, 2 years or at least 8 months by the time of permanent orders. He thinks it'll grow $60,000 a month or $720,000 when it's finally done. He's got two other businesses selling novelties and doing Christmas stores. So he's a very successful entrepreneur. She is not. Neither has education. I think she's got some diesel mechanic training. Other than that, I don't know if they have any advanced education
at all. But contrary to what you said earlier in your argument, that she has been a substantial factor in the economic success of both parties over the life of the marriage?
Well, she worked with him. They worked together.
What you're saying is she worked with him, but she wasn't qualified to run a business herself.
He testified that she knows a little bit about running a bar, knows nothing about food service, and the new one had food service. So he's in the position now to have a very successful future. She is not. The court didn't address that at all, and we think that's a very important factor. Second point we make is my client, after she lost the first bar, purchased another bar, and the only testimony concerning the purchase of that bar was given by her at the permanent orders hearing. She and the husband had claimed it was purchased with marital property. She said, no, I paid $45,000 for the bar. $5,000 came from my mother, $15,000 came from a friend, and I owe $25,000. The court, and that was not contradicted at all.
Counsel, you just said the husband claimed that it came from marital property. Where is that in evidence?
I don't think it is. Pardon me?
I thought you just said that the husband claims that it came from marital property.
Right.
Well, where is that claim made? In the briefs here or in the trial court?
And in the trial, they made that claim. But there was no evidence supporting it. The only evidence came from my client, and she said that's where she got the money, still owed $25,000. And the trial court ruled the court received no documents verifying the source of $45,000 for the purchase price.
Counsel, let me say, this is the Binder's Bar?
Binkers.
Pardon me?
Binkers.
Binders. What exception to the general rule in 1410.113.2 is there that would say this is not marital property? I mean, it was acquired, wasn't acquired by gift, it wasn't exchanged for premarital property, it wasn't acquired after a legal separation, was it?
Well, it could, yeah. We're not saying it's not marital property. I've misspoke. We're saying that the funds used to purchase it were not marital funds. And the court found they were marital funds, and therefore said the bar is worth $45,000. Each side got half of that.
Did the court take into account the debt that existed there?
No. Just said there's no documentation, so I'm not, in other words, just disbelieve my client, but that's the only testimony going to the purchase of the bar at all. The third point we get is that the petitioner's brother conveyed his house to the petitioner. Petitioner claimed it on real estate as being rental property, claimed it on a application for loan as investment property, yet the trial court found that he held it in trust, and that's set forth in the brief. I just have a minute and a half left, so unless there are questions, I'd like to save that.
May.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Chris Ward, registration 34196. I'm here on behalf of petitioner who is the appellee in this matter. And for the ease of argument, I will refer to him as petitioner, if that's okay with the court. May it please the court, the standard that we're here under is a clear abuse of discretion, and there must be convincing evidence to the contrary in order to overturn the trial court's rulings. The case law is clear that the trial court is the trier of fact, and an appellate court cannot overturn the credibility of evidence, the credibility of witnesses, the weight that a trier of fact gives, unless there is a clear abuse of discretion and then there is evidence to the contrary. And I submit to the court in this case that there is nothing to the contrary, and the record clearly supports Judge Offler's findings of facts and her distribution of the marital property. First, I'll address the award of the family home to petitioner. Petitioner was awarded 60% of the property, that is true, but part of that was also part of his own separate property that he had prior to the marriage and the business that he was able to take over once respondent was unable to run that business, and he brought that back up.
The separate property is included in that division?
What
separate property?
The Quitman property was his separate property, and Judge Offler specifically stated that that was part of his separate property that she was considering.
Which equipment?
It's Quitman.
Quitman property.
Sorry. Quitman is the property of the street that it's on. And just for ease of reference, I'll reference all of the properties based upon the street where they're located. That may be the easiest way. So that was considered in the division of property. The other thing that the court did was the court assigned certain debts to both parties and specifically stated that these were petitioner's debts and these other ones were respondent's debts. And the court specifically stated that in order to more evenly distribute the property, that even though the debts were assigned to respondent, that petitioner was ordered to pay those. And in the division of those debts, petitioner was ordered to pay 91% of the marital debt. That's a significant amount. Respondent walked away with liquid assets. She walked away with the rental property. She walked away with vehicles, with her retirement account, and with other property. And in addition, she walked away from the majority of the marital debt. And in this case, that is significant. Judge Offler specifically stated in awarding the home on Independence Avenue that this home should go to petitioner because he was the one who had primary residential custody of the children, and that even after respondent complied with the terms in the CFI stipulation, it would be a significant amount of time before she would have either unsupervised or overnights with the children. So that was one of the significant factors that the court considered. Judge Offler, in her ruling, also stated that she recognized the contribution that the respondent made. She recognized that this was a property that she had owned previous to the marriage, but she said that there was nothing that controverted the fact that she quit claimed that property to the marriage and that it became marital property. As far as the values that were assigned to the property, there were rulings that were made by both the magistrate's divisions and Judge Offler's divisions that prohibited respondent from presenting evidence regarding any values. And part of that was because there were separate discovery proceedings, there were separate disclosure proceedings, all of which ended in contempt, finding that respondent had failed to provide that information, had refused to follow the court's order, and remained in contempt. And that continued all the way until the trial in this matter. And Judge Offler, when Mr. McFarland asked to enter certain evidence, asked him specifically how letting respondent enter evidence at this late date, 2 years after the petition was filed, and some 18 months after her initial disclosures were due, how that was not contravening the court's orders. Mr. McFarland had no response other than to say it was not fair that she not be allowed to present evidence. And again, I go back to the clear abuse of discretion with evidence to the contrary, that it was only her testimony that she was allowed to present.
There was something which caused me concern. with the wife argues that the finding that each party should receive $11,500 from a $23,000 withdrawal husband, in my judgment, is not clear. From my review of the record, it appears that the court may have confused wife's $23,000 withdrawal from her tennis account with either the husband's $30,000 withdrawal from his Janice account or his $30,000 line of credit on Jamming Joe's. I find it difficult to reconcile the trial court's division of, quote, the $23,000 that Mr. General took out with the evidence in the record. Well, I wonder if you could help us. I would suggest And I will suggest the consideration of remanding for clarification on this point. But if you can help me, I would appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor. The funds that Mr. Jindal were charged with withdrawing were from his own retirement account. Both parties had Janice retirement accounts, and there was significant evidence that was given by Mr. Jindal that he dissipated that asset in order to pay for necessary living expenses, in order to keep pay certain debts that he was ordered to pay at the temporary orders. And that was the funds that he withdrew from his retirement account. The judge did account for that in the final orders by stating that he didn't provide enough evidence that these were necessary expenses, and so he was going to be charged back with that. So that was an asset that was actually put back into the marital estate, even though for all intents and purposes it no longer existed, and both parties were credited with that. And then the judge, Judge Offler, offset part of that with other awards that were given to respondents. Does that answer your...
So you don't think there's any error associated with that? That particular part of the distribution?
No, Your Honor, I do not. As I think Judge Offler was very clear in her ruling, which was some, I think, 18 pages, that was a verbal ruling that was since transcribed, very clear of each piece of property. She even went through certain property where she specifically said she assigns no value to the property, but then she states who she's going to award it to. And the case law is clear with Balancing and other cases that the court does not have to assign a value to a piece of property, but if that is part of their consideration,
but it must be. Didn't the trial judge find that each party should receive $11,500 from a $23,000 withdrawal of husbands? Did she, Chief, make that?
She did. And that was part of the cash payment that petitioner was ordered to pay to respondent. He was ordered to come up with those funds out of other funds in order to pay back an asset that no longer existed within the marital estate.
I understand that.
So there was an asset, the retirement account.
The petitioner was ordered to pay that, or was it just taken into the accounting?
It was taken into accounting, but the $11,500, he was ordered to specifically pay that back to her. That was part of the cash award that she received. And he was specifically ordered to pay.
Could the court possibly have confused the wife's $23,000 withdrawal from her Janice account with the husband's $30,000 withdrawal from his Janice account, or his line of credit on Jamming Joe's of $30,000?
I do not believe so, Your Honors, and I'm looking.
Well, I'm confused about that, I must confess, and I wasn't clear.
Part of the, and I submitted this as part of my closing argument, there was a balance sheet that was submitted, and the Janice funds, you'll see on there, and I'm not sure if the court has this or if it's in the record, but Mr. Jindal's Janice funds is specifically stated as a zero, and this was part of...
Well, it could be zero after the withdrawal.
Correct, and that was part of how it was divided. The court determined that was the value before he divided it, and the only way to make that an equitable division was she split it down the middle and ordered him to pay her half.
So the court determined that the value was $23,500 before it withdrew.
Correct. And then in order to effectuate a fair and equitable distribution, the court ordered him to pay her back that portion that he withdrew and was able to have access to those funds. The other issue of this, the respondent argues that...
I'll point one further question on this issue. I find it difficult to reconcile the trial court's division of the $23,000 that Mr. Jindal took out, and I think that's the quote from the order, with the evidence in the record that we have here today for us. Sir, that How should we read all this?
And just so for clarification, it's the fact that it was withdrawn or the fact of how it was divided in the end?
The trial court made a division, as the way I understand, of the $23,000 that Mr. Jindal took out. That's what she said.
Correct. And so it's, if I understand your question correctly, it's reconciling the fact that Mr. Jindal was ordered to pay back those portions, or the fact that it seemed to have been double dipped back in the whole marital property.
Well, that, I think that there's a further order that half of that $23,000 or $11,500, that each party should receive half of it.
And that is what happened. I mean, Mr. Jindal effectively received none of it because he had already had the benefit of using those funds, but then he was ordered to pay Ms. Jindal the actual cash, so she had the benefit of the same funds. The other issue is the economic circumstances of the parties, and I think that was definitely considered by the court. The court stated that respondent had purchased a new business, that she had that up and running. There were differences of opinion regarding the liquor license and the other issues that had gone along with the bar that petitioner had. Petitioner's bar was called Jam and Joe's. Respondent's bar was called Binker's, and there was some confusion around the liquor license because respondent took the liquor license from Jam and Joe's and refused to sign it back. So I think the court definitely considered the fact that she had a bar that was up and running and was able to make money. It considered the fact that in temporary orders, she argued that she was the only one who could get Jam and Joe's up and running. She was the only one who had the wherewithal to get that done, and in fact, she did open it. So the judge considered her past performance and the fact that she was able to support herself through those businesses. The other other point on appeal is the resulting trust that was made between Mr. Jindal and his brother. The property was transferred to Mr. Jindal on the eve of possible foreclosure for Mr. Randy Jindal.
Well, the long and short of all that, wasn't it? Is that correct? Am I correct in assuming that the court said whether there was evidence to support the proposition that this was an offense payment of the brother's wages salary?
That's correct. For 2 years, the mortgage was paid in lieu of paying salary because Mr. Randy Jindal worked on the home. This is a large home. Mr. Randy Jindal did extensive amount of work, and that was not controverted it at testimony in the trial.
How do you account for listing it on his balance sheet in the loan application and in other ways listing it as his own property?
I count that for the fact that it was actually titled in his name. He listed all property that was titled in his name. So in order to avoid perjuring himself, he listed all property that was titled in his name. He received no other beneficial receipt. He got nothing else beneficial from that, and there were two different signed agreements between Randy Jindal and the petitioner regarding the Mr. Randy Jindal could refinance the property and take it back at any time without any further notice. There was correct, and the petitioner, we presented exhibits both 19 and 23, I believe, that were the agreements between Mr. Jindal and his brother that stated specifically that Mr. Randy Jindal could take the property back at any time without any further recourse, without any payment. All he had to do was simply refinance it into his name. And I think that in and of itself is a resulting trust, and that property was properly excluded from the marital estate.
And would the record show when those agreements were entered into?
And this, one of them was in 2001, June of 2001, and the other one, I believe, was May of 2007.
That was, the second one was after the parties had separated, or the petition had been filed?
No, the second one was prior to the filing for divorce.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. McFarland?
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think you have about a minute 23.
Mr. McFarland, can you address that $23,000? Do you think there's some error in that particular distribution?
Yes. I think the court straight out confused it, that it was $30,000 was taken out of the Janus account by the husband, by the petitioner, and he spent that. And I think that's what the court was doing, was saying that $30,000 should be divided between the parties, and the court mistakenly said $23,000. So I think that's clearly $30,000. On the issue of when that second agreement or a statement that the defendant's brother could buy the property back, that was filed a month before petitioner filed for divorce in this case. So he was just setting up, I think.
In that divorce confusion, do you think that that $23,000, the court may have confused that $23,000 with the wife's withdrawal of $23,000 from her account.
It could have done that.
And therefore, yeah, it should have been $30,000, which should have been divided, right, or taken into consideration rather than the $23,000.
That's what we're saying.
Yeah. Thank you.
On other issues, in response, and I've only got 16 seconds, there was no separate property in the division. The appreciation of Mr. Jandel's separate property during the marriage was divided. That was in the division, but not the property itself. There's no separate property divided. And
thank you very much, Mr. McFarland.
Thank you.
Thank both counsel for your arguments. The matter is under advisement, and a decision will be forthcoming in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So I think we are adjourned.
All right.